Well, Friday, my day off, I conveniently managed to break a couple ribs. I say conveniently because that caused me to be able to do nothing but lie in bed, and I finished still standing. I had heard that Tom Dreesen wrote it, and my buddy Sean had kind of said, "Hey, did you hear this is out?" And I said, "Wow, go to Amazon, get a copy." And of course, Amazon being Amazon, it was here the next day. So I gave you a link on Raleigh.net to that. And if you want to get a copy, I think if you're unsure now, you will be sure within the next hour, I do believe. Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage in Sinatra, Tom Dreesen. And whether you're from Illinois or the environs, or whether you're just like to laugh, and by the way, that was the only downside of the book. When you're breaking ribs, you don't want to read something that makes you laugh. And there were a few times where it was very hard to control that. But if you're a Sinatra fan, of course, well, then you know Tom. Or maybe you watch television. It's almost impossible that you don't. So, Tom, welcome to WGN Radio.
Did you have to break two ribs to read my book?
You know, I was already reading it to begin with because it came last week. But when the ribs broke and I could do nothing else, I said, this is the perfect time to read this book. And it was a real surprise. And I say that not because I didn't expect it to be good and compelling, which it is, but this is really an intimate look at somebody who rose from situations that other people might use to explain why they were victims, really to the top. And all along the way, you recognized you were blessed at every step of the way. I said earlier you went from Harvey to Hollywood and didn't lose yourself along the way, and you didn't. It's a great book.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I'm a motivation speaker. I'm a stand-up comedian, first, last, and always. That's who I am, a stand-up comedian. When I found that, I found out where I believe I was put on this planet. But I do give motivation talks because I read literally, you know, maybe hundreds of books on the powers of mind when I was in the service and stuff like that. And one of the things that I talk to students about is don't let them talk you into being a victim. You're a victor. You were born a winner, you know, and throughout your, you know, my life, I had every excuse imaginable to not be a success, except that I didn't want that to happen, and I wouldn't allow that to happen, that let my past dictate my future, you know. And I've always believed that life is 10% of what happens to you, but 90% of how you react to it, you know. So I'm glad you found that out in the book, and I won't let myself be a victim, and nor should anyone, you know.
No, you prove it page after page in this book, and to say the least, it was not only rough growing up in Harvey, but you were a Cubs fan and Harvey on top of it, so. You certainly.
In those days, They were all Sox fans in my neighborhood, but I didn't know. When I was 5 years old, I was listening to Cub games on the radio because my dad was a Cub fan. So I'd hear it on the radio, you know, and I became a Cub fan at 5 and 6 years old. But I didn't realize I was in enemy territory.
Oh, yeah.
You know, by the time I was 8 years old, I could take a punch. You know, White Sox fans hated Cub fans.
And still do, really. And yes. I thought that was interesting because you had so many wonderful jokes about the Cubs and the White Sox also of their lackluster showings. And then, of course, you lived to see the Cubs prove everybody wrong and win a series.
Yes. It only took 108 years.
Yeah, that was all.
108 years, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, and the irony is Jerry Reinsdorf is a real good friend of mine. We have dinner in Chicago at Gibson's all the time, and I love Jerry. He's a wonderful guy, great sense of humor, and he knows I'm a Cub fan, but he teases me all the time. It's a little bit different, but I remember when I was a kid, even when I came out of the service, there were bars on the south side of Chicago, White Sox bars, that if you were a Cub fan, you didn't dare go in there, you know. And even, I'll tell you something interesting, Mike Downey, who used to write for the Chicago Tribune, is a good friend of mine. He called me when looked like the White Sox were going to play St. Louis in the World Series. And he said, if the White Sox play the St. Louis Cardinals, who are allegedly the Cubs' rivals, if they play the Cardinals, who will Cub fans root for, White Sox or for Cardinals? I said, no doubt the Cardinals. They would not want the White Sox to win. But I'm not that avid. You know, I would root for any Chicago team. You know.
Well, I love that joke you sold early on. Did you get $100 for it?
A charity, the Sports Illustrated, gave me $100 to donate to my favorite charity.
Okay.
If for the best sports joke of the year. That was back in the day when the Cubs and the White Sox were always in their last place. And I said, my prayer when I was a kid growing up, because the Cubs and White Sox were so that my prayer growing up that I used to pray that the Cubs and White Sox would merge so Chicago would only have one bad team.
That's so funny. Now, I got to say, before I started to read the book, and when it was still okay to laugh for me, I had seen some of your routines online, and there's one line that I still laugh to this minute every time I think about it, and that was your argument that yes, man's best friend, a dog, loves you more than your wife, and you had a litmus test, and it was the funniest damn thing I ever heard.
Thank you. Yeah, I say, you know, my buddy said, you know, that his wife is his best friend. I said, no, a dog is a man's best friend. He said, my wife is my best friend. I said, put your wife and your dog in the trunk of your car, leave them there for an hour, open the trunk, see which one is happy to see you.
It's so true. Absolutely. So, you're a philosopher on top of everything else. Just actually, that's something that came across in the book. In many ways, you are a philosopher, and you got to see both sides of life, and on stage and behind the stage, and your experiences are just priceless. Now, it also didn't surprise me, by the way, that here you are in Harvey with not a whole lot of opportunity, and although you live near the Dells, so I got to tell you, when I first heard that, I said, oh man, he lived in the Dells neighborhood, so I thought that was really neat. But, you know, going into the service and all that was, you know, almost an upgrade for most folks in your situation. But to come back, do some labor jobs, I got that. But I was astounded that you became like the number one life insurance salesman.
Well, actually, not number one life insurance salesman. When I came out of the service, I went in the Navy when I was 17. I was a high school dropout at 16 because I had eight brothers and sisters. We were raggedy poor. We lived in a shack in Harvey, you know, a rat-infested, roach-infested shack. If a window broke, you stuck a rag in it. If you had holes in your shoes, you put cardboard in it, you know. And none of this, you know, I shined shoes in taverns. I set pins in bowling alleys. I caddied in the summertime. I sold newspapers on the corner, all to help feed my brothers and sisters. And none of this do I regret. But I dropped out of high school my sophomore year. You know, you're going to school and high school kids are dressing nice and they got cars and everything. I was a raggedy kid with holes in my shoes and sometimes embarrassed to go to school. At age 17, I went in the Navy and got a high school diploma from the Navy. And then I went to junior college nights when I came out studying political science and taking some other courses. But I was wandering aimlessly. I did not know what it is I wanted to do in life. You know, I kept going from job to job to job. I was a private detective for a while. I was always a bartender, and especially in the wintertime. I worked construction. And in the wintertime, when you couldn't work construction in Chicago, I would tend bar, you know. I ended up working on a loading dock. I was a teamster loading trucks at Jones Motor, and then after a while, I dropped my card and became a foreman. And so but every job I did well at, but I felt so unfulfilled. And finally, a friend talked me into selling life insurance for Columbus Mutual, and I was real good at it. I was in a civic group at that time called the JCs, the Junior Chamber of Commerce, and I had a lot of outreach there in the community. And the first year I became a member of the $1 Million Roundtable, and the second year I quit and went in the show business.
Yeah.
You know, I sold a lot of life insurance the first year, and halfway through the second year I went in the show business, and the president of Columbus Mutual flew into Chicago and said, I've never done this for any of our agents, but I can't believe you're leaving this wonderful business where you've got a great foundation to go into such a precarious business as show business, you know, but I had the bug bad, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, and of course, what I got from the book was that the real impetus to even be asked to sell life insurance, you had the gift of gab and you were great with people. And so you had all the makings of being in show business that were actually the skills that would pay off in trying to sell people insurance.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, though. Tim Reed and I were America's first black and white comedy team. We met in the JCs, and we wrote a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor, a concept that we had, get the kids laughing, play some music, and then plant the seeds of the ills of drug abuse. And in those days, they weren't teaching drug education at a high school or college level, let alone at an elementary school level. And so one day a little eighth grade girl, Tim and I used to make the kids laugh. One day a little eighth grade girl leaving the classroom said, you guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team. And the thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us because no one had ever done that before in America. And so we decided, hey, let's try that. We start writing what we thought was material. We recruited a good buddy of mine named Dickie Owings, a guy that I've known since childhood, and he was just a funny guy and a good writer. And we recruited him to help us. And we ended up going there were no comedy clubs in those days. So, you know, we ended up going, worked all black clubs on the north, in the north side of, south side of Chicago. And then we worked all white nightclubs too later on, but what they affectionately called the Chitlin' Circuit, black owned, black operated nightclubs. But the first night we ever went on stage in a little jazz club, we followed this jazz group. We started out and something I had written got a laugh. And I remember like it was yesterday, 51 years ago this was, it was like an epiphany that got a laugh and my whole being went, oh yeah, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to be. I want to be a stand-up comedian. And to be honest with you, Raleigh, you know, you read the book. I couldn't sleep all that night. It was a Friday night. And I woke up in, Saturday morning. I got up Saturday morning and I ran down to Ascension Church where I had been an altar boy in Harvey and where I went to church every Sunday. And I prayed. I said, God, I now know what I want. I've been wandering aimlessly. If you let me make my living as a comedian, I'll never ask for anything else. I'll do charity work and all that stuff, you know, make all them promises. That was 51 years ago, but that was September 1969 that I got on my knees in that church. September 2019, 50 years later, I went back to that same church and I spoke. I gave the sermon on Sunday Mass called The Power of Prayer. And I told the congregation 50 years ago on this date, I knelt right over there and asked God, let me make my living as a stand-up comedian, and I'll do charity work, I'll do everything. Well, God kept his promise, and I kept mine, and that was 50 years ago. And do prayers work? Yes, they do, you know.
Oh, absolutely they do. I think increasingly we're starting to see scientific evidence that of that as well, but the anecdotal evidence is just overwhelming. Still Standing is the book, My Journey from the Streets and Saloons to the Stage in Sinatra, Tom Dreesen, who is my guest. And you're from Chicago, you probably know Tom. Certainly you know of him. Got any questions, any comments, give us a call, 888-876-5593. That's 888-ROLLYE on WGN Radio.
Roll around heaven all day.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. Of course, that's Frankie Lane, another Chicago boy. Lucky Old Son. Yeah, 1949, Mercury number one 8 weeks, and it was 71 years ago today it hit the number one spot on the Billboard charts. Yeah, takes me right back to Chicago. As does Tom Dreesen, Still Standing, a terrific read. I've got a link on Raleigh.net to the book. And I said, you got any questions? And of course, I knew that would open the floodgates. So let's talk to Rick in Chicago. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Hi, Raleigh. Very nice to talk to you.
Thanks.
My name is Rick, and I'm retired. I'm 81 years old. But back in the day, for 35 years, I was a drummer in Chicago, and I played in show bands. And in 1970, I was with the first band. We opened up the Blue Max, the Regency Hyatt House, the showroom in Rosemont. And one of the acts that we, or the opening acts we had, and I remember it was Tim and Tom. And I can't remember who they opened for exactly, because I know that people mentioned that they enjoyed Tim and Tom better than they did the main act. And I think they came in a couple of times. They were opening act a couple of times. And I just wanted to say hello to Tom and see if he remembered the Blue Max, the Regency Hyatt House. This would have been 1970, or the beginning of 1971. So that was pretty early in their career, I think.
Yeah, Rick, I do remember the Blue Max. And we opened for the Beatles, and I people said that they liked us better than the Beatles. I remember that. No, Rick, I do remember the Blue Max. It was a great showroom.
They were.
It was a great showroom, and a guy named Monroe later became the maitre d' there. He used to be the maitre d' at Mr. Kelly's. Monroe, I think Elfenbein was his name. I never
Elfenbein,
forgot.
Monroe Elfenbein, right, and Peter was his assistant.
Yes, yeah, it was a great show. In those days, you know, Raleigh, there were so many rooms like that in Chicago. You know, there weren't comedy clubs in Chicago, so you had to work nightclubs, you know, like Mr. Kelly's or like the Blue Max and you know, rooms like that. It was where there would be a singer and a comedian or a comedian and a singer. It was a great era. It's a great era.
Yes, absolutely. All right, Rick.
It was, I remember one of the other fellows was Billy Falbo. used to come in there. He was an old Chicago comedian, too.
Great comedian, yeah.
You guys were fresh. You guys were fresh and different. And I remember you like it was just yesterday, and that was a few years ago. So I'm glad that you did very well. And I know that Tim went on, too, then for WKRP after that, and things opened up for you guys.
We stayed together 6 years. Thank you so much, Rick. Somebody said you bought a dozen, you're going to buy a dozen copies of my book to give away for Christmas. Don't do that. Six is fine.
Yeah.
Six is fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Right. Well, maybe.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Tim and Tom thing is so interesting because for people who lived in that era, we remember that that was a gutsy thing to do because racial tensions were pretty high. So to say, we're going to be a black and white comedy team, what made you think that would go over?
Well, you know, both of us, you know, were young and we were, you know, energetic. And immediately we thought there had never been a black-white comedy team before. And I always liked to be the first. I always, I did an album in front of an all-black audience. No white comedian had ever done that before. I did it, actually in Harvey, after the team split up, because no white guy had ever done an album in front of an all-black audience. And it always annoyed me because I used to work black clubs all the time, and white people would come up to me and say, "Do black people laugh at your material?"
Oh,
and my line always has been, "What color is laughter?"
Yeah.
What's the color of laughter? So that's why I went out and did the album in front of an all-black audience. So whenever a white person would come up and say, "Do black people laugh at your material?" I'd pull out a CD and say, "Give me $12.99 and you can find out for yourself."
Yeah.
But you know, you're right. The era 60, when we went on stage the first time was September 1969. You didn't see a black guy and a white guy walking down the street together, let alone on a stage together. And it was, and if you remember, those who remember that era, you're too young, Raleigh, but there were, there were riots all over America, race riots all over America, and Harvey had one of the biggest riots in the country, right in the neighborhood that I grew up in. And the students were protesting the Vietnam War. You know, I just got out of the service, Tim just got out of college, and America was in turmoil. And we went everywhere, and here we were going across the land trying to make people laugh. Anywhere there was racial tension, we went there, not to preach, to make them laugh, in colleges and high schools. We did 11 prisons in 1 year. We did the county jail 3 times in 1 year. Anywhere there was racial tension, we went there to make them laugh, make people laugh. You know,
it's hilarious. It really is hilarious. And what's interesting about that is, like you say, you were young guys and all that, and you almost didn't know enough to say, "Well, this won't work." And it did. It absolutely did. And there's a lot about that in Still Standing. And one hilarious joke that Tom Dreesen wrote, and at first Tim had chastised him for that. And we're going to get to that story and a lot more. Your calls as well, 888-876-5593. That's 8888 R-O-L-L-Y-E on WGN Radio.
My darling, I want to hurt you again.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. That's Nappy Brown. Don't Be Angry. 1955 on Savoy. Got a number 2 on the R&B charts, 25 on the pop charts, and if we were still around, he'd be 91 years old today. Died in his sleep, sadly, September 2008, and that was his first and probably biggest hit, Don't Be Angry. All right, we're talking with Tom Dreesen. Still Standing is the book. It's just out. Like I say, I ordered it on Amazon, got it the next day. I've got a link at Raleigh.net to it. It is a great read. If you'll like comedy, who doesn't? If you like some of the biggest named entertainers, and of course we'll get to Frank Sinatra, you know that. Tom toured with him for 14 years. Or just want to read about a life well lived from beginnings that were, well, beyond humble, to say the least. It's all in there and a lot more. We'll also find out what happened at the comedy club, because everybody who goes into that gig and gets paid today owes a debt of gratitude to Tom in many ways. But I opened the lines, and that's, of course, 888-876-5593. And that brings us Mary from Chicago. Welcome to WGN Radio. You're on with Tom, Mary.
Oh, hi. Well, Raleigh, sorry to hear about your boo-boo. But,
oh, thanks.
You're a tough cookie. I don't have to worry about you, right?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, good. Take care. And Tom, how perfect that Tom's on a Columbus Day, because I can't help but thinking about Sinatra so much lately with everything, the way the world has been for so long. I mean, couldn't you imagine if it's almost like, we need Sinatra here to fix this place up. He'd be like, what's going on? Hello?
Yeah, yeah. No question about it. In fact, when they tore that statue down or took the statue down to Columbus, I thought about him that day. I said, if he was alive, he would be saying to me, Tommy, what's going on in Chicago? You know, where are those guys at in Chicago that let that happen?
Like, we got to go bring Julie with us.
Yes.
Taking care of everything.
Yeah. I know what his response would have been to that. For those who don't know, Julie Rizzo was Frank's bodyguard for years and years and years, his real good buddy. And Frank had this strange sense of humor. You know, Julie had one eye, a glass eye. He was a tough guy. I think he got it knocked out in a fight. And, of course, Sammy Davis Jr. had a glass eye. So one Christmas, Frank bought a set of binoculars, sawed it in half, and sent one to Julie and one to Sammy.
That's great. That's a wonderful story.
I got to read your book.
Yes, you do. It's great, Mary, and I'm so glad you called. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Mary.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember I did time in Miami, among other cities, and Jilly's Yen across the street from the Fountain Blue was just the boat to be all boats. You know, some people had a houseboat. He had, like, the entire condominium, it looked like, on the water.
Yeah, he was a character. He was a street guy. You know, like, I always say that about myself. I don't have a degree from academia, but I got a doctorate from the streets. I grew up on the streets, and Jilly and I connected on that level, you know. He tried to hustle me a couple times, but I knew where he was coming from, you know. But we ended up having just a great friendship, you know.
Well, that comes out in the book, too, and that's so interesting because there's no doubt he was a tough guy, but that doesn't mean that you're not a good guy. And, in fact, it also comes out throughout the book that when you really talk about integrity and honor, many of the people who at a distance might seem to be dishonorable characters actually had more character than some of the most pious out there.
I have met more educated fools in my life than I have uneducated fools.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like the more education someone got, that the less common sense they got sometimes. You know, and I'd rather deal with somebody who has common sense rather than a great education, you know.
Yeah.
Especially today, because I think that our kids are coming out of colleges with... I read somewhere that those who graduated from grade school at the turn of the century, had a better education overall than college grads today.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, you see it when they interview kids. My biggest, I've worked, shows on college campuses, and I talk to college students all the time. I'm stunned by how little they know about history. I'm stunned how little they know about World War II. They know nothing about it. If you ask them about it, they don't realize that had the men and women, and I'm going to get on a soapbox here for a minute, forgive me, I'm an ex-GI, but the men and women of that era, if it wasn't for them, we'd be in concentration camps. There's no doubt what Adolf Hitler had in mind for this country. There's no doubt what Imperial Japan had in mind for this country. You know, and there would be no Chicago Cubs, no, you know, Chicago White Sox or Chicago Bulls if it wasn't for the men and women of that era. When they were 17, those young guys, 17 and 18 years old, if you ask a young kid today, do you know anything about Guadalcanal or Macon Island, or do you know anything about Iwo Jima or the Battle of the Bulge, they have no knowledge whatsoever. But if it wasn't for those places and those men and women, they wouldn't have the freedoms that they have today.
I agree wholeheartedly, and what's really frightening to me now, because the government halls of indoctrination, known as the public schools, that teach you how to think teach you what to think instead of how to think. I was reading just today articles that were interviewing college students, almost all of whom were thinking that socialism was a good thing, that communism worked, and their rhetoric, when you listen to this, it's like, did you miss history? Did they ever teach you anything about World War II or before? And so it is, we're considered fossils, I know, but it is alarming the path we're walking. But we could go on with this all night. And Judy wants to say hello. So welcome to WGN Radio, Judy.
Hi there. I'd like to tell you about the first time I met Tim. I went to a gathering for the JCs, and he's going to recognize my voice right away.
Yeah,
I went to a gathering for the JCs, and I wanted to meet Tim and really bad, and everybody was crowded around him, and I finally got in there and I said, "Aren't you part of that comedy team?" Tim and Tommy said, "Yeah. How do you do? Your name?" And I said, "I'm so excited to meet you." I said, "Are you Tim or Tom?"
Oh.
He said, "I'm Tim." I said, "God, it's so great to meet you." And Tommy comes walking up and said, "Timmy, have you met my sister, Judy?"
Oh, jeez.
Timmy said, oh, there's more than one comedian in this family.
I recognize the voice. That is my sister, Judy.
I have to stand on a soapbox for my brother because I want you to know, as one of the little children, I was 5 years younger than him. There was always laughter in our house, always laughter when he was home. He made fun for us. He created games for us kids to play, and we tormented our father to death over it. But, he was so creative even back then. And I think at that point he was only like 15, 16. And he was always coming up with stuff for us to do and laugh. And we cried and cried when he went to the Navy because we missed that kind of laughter in the house. But there's my soapbox, honey. I just want you to know I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of you. And
thank you.
I want you to know that you're in our prayers every day.
Well, thank you very much, sis, and you too. Raleigh, this is you know, I remember the day she was born. They brought her home, you know.
Yeah.
And I always, you know, I hate brothers and sisters, but I always say, you know, and I think I said in my book, this thing about sibling rivalry that, you know, when you were the baby of the family and then the new baby came, that you had this rivalry. I never had that with this girl. I've loved that girl since the first day I saw her, and nothing's changed in all those years.
Yeah.
Be careful what you say. Margie might be listening. I think she's on.
I know the audience is going, for God's sake, get them both.
No, absolutely not. This is just great. Absolutely great. Judy, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for letting me call. Tommy, love you.
Love you too.
Talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
So I don't think you're related to Karen, but she is from Harvey, so maybe you are. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for taking the call. Tommy, there's a street named after you here in Harvey, by the hospital. I'm heading there now for the night shift. So I was wondering how long that street, when was it named?
It was named in August 22nd, 1992, and I used to sell newspapers on that corner. And there's a great story in the book about that, that when I was 8 years old, I was selling newspapers, and all the cars in Harvey were blowing horns, and people were coming out of everywhere, and thousands of people blowing horns, and Harvey was a thriving metropolis in those days. And I asked one of the elders, what's going on? They said, it's Lou Boudreaux Day. And they explained to me, Lou Boudreaux's from Harvey, and he played shortstop for the Cleveland Indians at age 24. He managed the Cleveland Indians to a pennant and the World Series, and he's from Harvey. And I went down to the corner. I sold all my papers right there on 155th Street where the post office was in the Elks Club, and Lou Boudreaux came out of the Elks Club and people cheered, and I was so excited. Someone from Harvey was famous, and they took Lou Boudreaux down to Thornton Field, and I walked home, and I was thinking that day, like little boys do, gosh, somebody from Harvey, Illinois is famous. And like little boys do, I start fantasizing that, wow, maybe one day they'd have a parade for me in the band and all that. And you know, little boys dream that. August 22nd, 1992, I went back to that same corner in that street, Dreesen Street, and the guy who introduced me to the crowd was Lou Boudreaux.
Wow.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I'm about a block away from it right now.
Good deal.
I do have a question. Did you perform at one of the first Chicago Fest, the one at Navy Pier under Mayor Burns?
Yes, I did. I performed. Yeah, I did do that. Yeah, and by the way, thank you for what you do. You work at the hospital.
Yes.
I don't know if you folks get enough thanks for all you've done, especially during the COVID crisis.
Oh yes,
you people in the medical profession are just marvelous, just wonderful folks. Thank you for what you do.
Yes.
Thank you. And appreciate that.
And thanks for calling, Karen, and for listening. I appreciate both.
Yeah, I've just started listening to your show. I love it. Thanks.
Terrific. All right, so call me again. Yeah, it is such a wonderful read, and if you want to get in here, I'll try not to hog Tom, but having read Still Standing, yeah, there's a couple things I wanted to go over, but as I say, room for you, 888-876-5593, that's 8888-ROLLYE, and there's a link at Raleigh.net, ROLLYE.net, right on the homepage to Still Standing. You're just going to love it. I'm Raleigh James, it's WGN Radio.
Something's gotta give, something's gotta give, something's gotta give.
WGN Radio. Yes, of course, it's Sammy Davis Jr. It was actually his last hit on Reprise in 1968. Got to number 11 on the pop chart. 54 years ago tonight in 1966, Sammy was making a cameo appearance on Batman. Yeah, maybe you remember it. I know you remember Tom Dreesen. Still Standing is the current book, My Journey from the Streets and Saloons to the Stage in Sinatra. It's a great read. There's a link at Raleigh.net to the book. Yeah, the hour's going by just too quickly, but I promised I would defer to you, and that takes us to Randy from Shorewood, Illinois. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Hey, hey, good evening, everybody. It's an honor. Hello.
Yes. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Tom, I remember you on David Letterman. You were my favorite person, and Mary Tyler Moore were always my favorite. My two questions is, the very last time you were on David Letterman, you forgot to explain or tell a story about Frank Sinatra. Was that true?
Yeah, you know, David, you know, they normally pre-interview you and tell, like, on all the talk shows. You know, I did like 50 David Letterman shows. In fact, he even let me host the show when he had the shingles. And they would pre-interview you, so you had funny stories to tell. But David would almost always not go to those questions. He would come out of the blue from everywhere, you know. You always had to be on your toes when you did David Letterman show, because hey, David's one of my best buddies in the whole world. But I always say, if you were in trouble on the Johnny Carson show, say like you were telling a story and it didn't go anywhere, Johnny would throw you a life jacket. He'd pull you out of it with a funny story. If you were going into the dumper on David's show, he'd throw you an anchor. So I never got around to the story that I was going to tell, yeah.
That's casual. Okay, because Mary Tyler Moore, her last time she was on, Tom, she did not say a dirty joke. She always told jokes on that show. You know, and I thought maybe both you guys did the same thing. You know, it's some similar. Secondly, my last question. My grandma's second cousin left Chicago, and he was a drummer for Frank Sinatra for 15 years. And I keep forgetting his name because my uncle that's still alive in Carolina, he tells me it like every so often. But he's from. They won a trip to go to Vegas, and the bass player and the piano player left, and he stayed out there, and Frank Sinatra picked him up. And I'm totally amazed by that to this day.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, Frank had something. When I was with Frank, Irv Cotler was his drummer for years, and another guy named Greg Fields later. But that, when I was, but you know, Frank. Frank had done a few shows before I met him. You know?
Yeah.
I toured with him 14 years. He was in the business for 62 years. You know?
Right. Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. I miss David Letterman. I really do. And it's so. I heard your voice on the radio. I go, it's got to be him. And then once you said something about Frank Sinatra, Tom, I kept calling the old number. And it didn't, they kept hanging up on me. And I heard an 88 number. I go, please let me go through. I was like, yeah, that's so cool, Tom.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did, Randy. It's so good to talk to you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it all. And take care, Tom. And your book is named what again, please?
Still Standing.
Okay, cool.
You can get it on Amazon.com.
Yeah, and you say, if you just remember, Rolleye.net, right on the homepage is a link.
Well, if anything goes fancy here, if that guy gets 6 books, maybe he could give me one right now.
Yeah. All right, thanks. Appreciate it. All right, good deal.
Tom. God bless you, cats, man.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
You told a great story about being surprised when you did the morning show on a hip-hop station in L.A. to find out that kids, who clearly were born after Sinatra was even no longer with us, revered him. It didn't surprise me at all, so I have to share my one Frank Sinatra story, and I only have one. I was working in Philadelphia, but I had to do a couple weeks in Austin, Texas, because I had taken the LBJ family to court, and I actually won, the only person ever defeat him in open court. But anyway, so for 2 weeks, I had to do shows from Austin. Unfortunately, came Thursday, May 14th, 1998, and the news, of course, hit. Now, the way it worked is right before my show, I would do a tease with the host on before me. And so I call and I get Sid Mark on the phone, who had made an entire career out of playing Frank Sinatra records.
Sure. Good friend of mine.
Oh, there you go. And so, you know, Sid said, Raleigh, I don't care about the tease. I'm too broke. I just can't. And so, you know, and I understood. And so, but the folks from the Austin radio station thought it was a bit. They said, come on. I said, no, Frank died. And they go, well, so? And, you know, they just found this to be hilarious. And so finally I looked at him. I said, you know, there's a reason that Philadelphia is a great city and Austin is a hellhole. And so
I performed Philly many times, the Spectrum with Frank and stuff like that. I'll tell you a quick question. When Frank died, Barbara called me and I went over the house And of course, all of his friends were there and everything. And it was a sad time, and paparazzi was everywhere outside the house. As I left the house, Barbara asked me to be a pallbearer. And, yeah. And then as I left the house, I was listening to a radio station, and a woman called in, and she said to the host, "There's something wrong with my husband. He fought in Korea. He fought in Vietnam." She said, "And at his father's funeral, he never wept. But today he came home halfway through the day, and he went into his room, and he's crying like a baby. I hear him in there sobbing." She said, "Because Frank Sinatra died." And she said, I don't understand. And but the host didn't have an answer, but I understood. Mm-hmm. If you were a true Frank Sinatra song, his music was the soundtrack of your life. You went steady to his music. You got married to his music. You got divorced to his music and were in that bar alone, you know, "One for My Baby," you know. It's quarter to three. There's no one in the place. Yeah. You got divorced to his music. You got remarried to his music. "Love is Love. You're the second time around." His music was the soundtrack of your life. And if you love Frank Sinatra's music and him, when he died, part of you died, you know, because a major part of your life died. And Sinatra fans knew that the next day the sun was going to shine. It just wasn't going to be as warm as it used to be.
Right. It was the passing of an era, and he typified that era so well, start to finish. And he's somebody who had experienced all the highest highs, but he also experienced all the lowest lows. And yeah. It was interesting that to the folks who didn't know all the rumors about, well, he's a made man and all this crap, the truth of the matter was I've never known anybody who knew him, and I did not have the pleasure of knowing him. You know, I think I met him once, but I didn't know him. But for the people I knew who did know him, they all to a person felt that he was honorable. If I had to pick one word for Frank Sinatra, it really would be honorable. And I have a feeling from reading your book that you concur with that.
He was loyal to a fault with his friends. You had to be very careful around to say you want, and "Gee, that's a nice painting," he'd take it off the wall and give it to you. If you said, "That's a beautiful watch," he'd take it off his wrist and give it to you. You had to be very careful around him about those kind of things. He was as good a friend as you'd ever have. He would stay with, no matter what, if you were his friend, he couldn't do enough for you. And he was loyal to a fault in many ways, you know. And was he a saint? No, but he did some saintly things in his life. And there's a lot of things you'll never know that he did, because he didn't want you to know. And if you were in his inner circle, you were sworn to secrecy. You did not talk about the benevolent things that he did. You know, but was he flawed? All of us are flawed. But he had an enormous talent, and he had a heart as big as you know, Wrigley Field.
And it was a great pairing for 14 years. I know you didn't take Sammy Davis Jr.'s advice when he said, "Don't stick with the same guy." You did for 14 years, and I think it very well enriched both of you, both on stage and behind it. I loved the book, Tom. I hope we will meet again, and I hope everybody will read Still Standing. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Raleigh. Let's do it again sometime. If I'm ever in Chicago, I'll come in studio. I've done so many shows at WJ, and that station has been so good to me through the years.
I'll count on it. Thanks.